From the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, this is NIH Research Radio. Welcome to episode 21 of NIH Research Radio, with news about the ongoing medical research at the National Institutes of Health, the nation's medical research agency. I'm your host, Bill Schmalfelt. Coming up on NIH Research Radio, results of a study supported by the National Institute on Drug Abuse suggests that young African-American adults, but not young white adults, are at high risk for HIV and other sexually transmitted diseases, even when their relative level of risk behavior is low. Wally Akinso has a report about one NIH Institute's effort to educate all Americans about the importance of knowing their family health histories. Special correspondent Cherry Graziosi sits down for a chat with Dr. Jane Pearson, chair of the Suicide Research Consortium at the National Institute of Mental Health. The subject, antidepressants and their association with suicidal thoughts in some patients. Wally will be back with a story about the identification of a gene that's linked to tobacco addiction. But first, newer doesn't always mean better, even in the world of medicine. That's straight ahead on NIH Research Radio. Maybe you've heard of Tai Chi, an ancient form of Chinese exercise. The National Institutes of Health is conducting a clinical research study to see if Tai Chi improves physical fitness and well-being for cancer survivors in the Washington, D.C. metro area. If that's you and you're between the ages of 18 and 60 and your last treatment was two or more years ago, call 866-999-1116 or log on to clinicaltrials.gov. The NIH is a nonprofit government agency, part of the Department of Health and Human Services. In modern popular culture, we're often led to believe that newer automatically translates to better. But that's not always the case, even in the world of medicine. For example, a new study shows that an older or first-generation drug called perphenazine was less expensive and no less effective than the newer second-generation antipsychotic medications used to treat schizophrenia. This suggests that the older antipsychotic medications still have a role in treating this condition, according to Dr. Philip Wang, director of the Division of Services and Intervention Research at the National Institute of Mental Health, which funded the study.
It turns out, despite what had been the thought in the field, the older drug actually cost less and was no less effective. So the bottom line is that, unlike what people had believed, which were the first generation drugs should be kind of reserved as a second line treatment, they actually look like they are very plausible first line treatments.
Dr. Wang was quick to point out that this does not mean that doctors treating patients with the newer second generation drugs should automatically switch their patients to the older, less expensive medication.
What it just means is that, unlike what people had been thinking, which is that these second generation drugs should just be used no matter what, it means that the older drugs still probably have a place, and we shouldn't forget to consider them in treating, you know, patients with schizophrenia.
The findings echo what was implied in the results of the first phase of the clinical antipsychotic trials of intervention effectiveness, otherwise known as the CATI trial, expanding treatment options for patients with schizophrenia. It casts doubts on the notion that the second-generation antipsychotics are better than the first-generation medications and suggests that perphenazine and the other first-generation antipsychotics may be just as beneficial for some patients. However, some conditions of the trial limit any firm conclusions about perphenazine's perceived advantages. For one thing, not all patients respond the same to different medications. And although the study lasted 18 months, which is long enough to determine how patients respond to and initially tolerate the drugs, it wasn't long enough to consider some serious long-term potential side effects. The study results were published in the December 1st issue of the American Journal of Psychiatry. One of the institutes here at the NIH has launched an outreach program designed to help a segment of the population learn about the importance of knowing their family health history. Wally Akinso has the report.
As part of the effort to educate all Americans about the importance of knowing their family health histories, the National Human Genome Research Institute, along with the acting U.S. Surgeon General Dr. Kenneth P. Maritsugu, announced two new outreach projects involving Alaska Native and urban Appalachian communities as part of the Surgeon General's Family Health Initiative. The projects, each of which will receive $100,000, will develop community-based models to increase awareness among the public and healthcare professionals about the value of family history information in promoting and preventing disease, according to Sarah Harding, the NHGRI's community outreach analyst.
Both of these projects are part of a series of family history demonstration projects. So these essentially are part of the U.S. Surgeon General's Family History Initiative, which began in 2004. Really what the education branch wanted to do was to encourage groups to engage their communities around family health history. So both of these demonstration projects are aimed at developing model programs of community engagement around family health history.
The new projects will expand upon what is being learned in NHGRI's Family History Demonstration Project at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. That effort, launched in November 2005, has been encouraging and evaluating the voluntary use of the Surgeon General's My Family Health Portrait, which is a web-based tool that organizes family health information into a printout that people can take to healthcare professionals to help determine whether they are at higher risk for disease. Harding said the NHGRI is excited about the potential of these projects to expand the reach and impact of the Surgeon General's Family Health Initiative.
These projects, we're really hoping that these establish models, things that we can report on, that we can write about, that can be successful engagements of a specific community, but then can be used by other groups. That's really the goal in these projects, is that it will give methods and materials and lessons to other groups that want to do things like this. Family history information is considered to be a very valuable and powerful tool in genomics and in medicine. Knowing your family history can reveal really important information about risk, both through genetics, through what you've inherited through your family, but also in your environment, what you eat, how much exercise you get. And so knowing your family history can really be the basis for figuring out what to do if you are at risk. So whether it's making changes in your diet or your daily activity or whatever that may be. But family history can help predict risk of diseases like breast cancer or osteoporosis or whatever it may be. It has been shown to be a very powerful tool, but just not one that people utilize as much as they could. Part of the hope with the U.S. Surgeon General's initiative and then these demonstration projects is that we can encourage individuals to collect their own family history information, bring it into their doctor, have a conversation about it, and that individuals are really starting to have this conversation with their own families to figure out what they might be at risk for.
In addition to the web-based tool, printable PDF versions and other resources related to the U.S. Surgeon General's Family Health Initiative are available at www.hhs.gov/family-history. This is Wally Akinso at the National Institutes of Health, Bethesda, Maryland.
When we come back, special correspondent Cherry Graziosi visits with a scientist from the National Institute of Mental Health to discuss antidepressants and their association with suicidal thoughts in some patients. That's next on NIH Research Radio. Got a youngster around the house who's on the heavy side but is otherwise healthy? The National Institutes of Health would like to talk to you to see what they can learn from your child. Not only are all study-related tests and treatments provided for free, but all participants are compensated. Check out clinicaltrials.gov or call 866-999-1116 for more info. NIH is a nonprofit government agency, part of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. It seems like a contradiction in terms, antidepressant medications leading to suicidal thoughts in some patients. On this edition of NIH Research Radio, special correspondent Cherry Graziosi takes the traveling microphone to the National Institute of Mental Health to learn more about this seeming paradox. Cherry.
Hi, Bill. We're here today with Dr. Jane Pearson, who is the chair of the National Institutes of Mental Health Suicide Research Consortium. And Dr. Pearson and I are going to be talking about a new study that will deal with antidepressants and how they're associated with suicidal thoughts in the United States. There's been a lot of talk about adolescents and children who have taken antidepressants and become suicidal. But Dr. Pearson, this study is going beyond that.
Yeah, what we're doing is funding five different studies, actually trying to address this from different angles. The dilemma is that the antidepressants look effective, particularly for adults. There's usually no question there. Where the question rose was the risk and benefit of the mostly serotonin reuptake inhibitors for children and adolescents. Was it effective enough to kind of counteract the potential risk for suicidality? So the FDA reviewed this through several hearings, ended up issuing a black box warning that basically alerts practitioners that there may be a risk of an association of suicidality increasing with the use of these SSRIs as a class. And they're actually going to be meeting soon again about trials with adults to take another look at this. So the dilemma here is, here are kids and adolescents primarily, but we had a workshop addressing the life course, looking at adults and older adults as well, anticipating that some of the science around this affects everybody. The challenge is for people with a depression where there may be suicidality, giving you a medication that could also increase the suicidality is a big dilemma. How do you monitor that? How do you try to determine whether this happens to be a person who's going to have this untoward effect from this medication? So the studies that we're funding now hopefully will address this from a number of different angles to get a better understanding of this.
Why are we talking about it now, though? Depression has been around for forever. And is it because of the children now that we're talking about? Are more and more children taking antidepressants?
Yeah, more people generally are taking these types of antidepressants because typically their side effect profile is much safer than the older antidepressants. So consequently, there's more primary care physicians and pediatricians who are prescribing this, whereas before with the tricyclics that had a pretty poor prognosis in an overdose, it was mostly restricted to psychiatrists who would monitor that. So with the broader use of these antidepressants, there's more concern about whether there's adequate monitoring of them.
Do you think that doctors now, because primary care doctors are now giving out antidepressants, not just psychiatrists, do you think a lot of times doctors are too quick on dispensing antidepressants?
The symptoms of depression are usually pretty clear, but we also know that patients can demand certain medications and are more likely to be given them if they walk into a doctor's office. We have some NIMH-funded research that suggests that. So we know the providers are under that pressure to do something, and we know that around antibiotics as well. So the consumers and their families really have to be educated about what to look for and what to monitor. And we know the indications box or the inserts are kind of hard to follow, hard to read. And so we're also kind of wondering what might be helpful for the public to understand about this and how you even estimate your own risk. What things do you look for? So in general, what the FDA tried to do was to alert everybody to this problem. You know, better to have people monitoring this better than not. But some of the research we'd like to promote would include different approaches to measuring this. What's a good way of asking an adolescent about side effects? What's a good way of asking about side effects or these symptoms that are both related to the disease and the side effect even before you start the medication, so you get a good baseline of your symptoms and can get a better understanding of what new problems might be coming up?
If a patient goes to a psychiatrist or a doctor with depression symptoms of depression, and the doctor prescribes the antidepressant, how long does it take for that antidepressant to work to where the patient is starting to feel some sort of normalcy?
People will talk about give it at least, you know, a couple weeks, sometimes 4 weeks, sometimes 6 weeks, and also depending on the dosing. So, and depending on the person's history, we've funded a couple of trials looking at different combinations of antidepressants and given people's histories, you know, what's likely to work, what isn't. Sometimes people will ask, is it a family member who's responded favorably to another antidepressant? So it's really, that part's still unfortunately an art form. We're trying to fund more research to look at the best potential combinations or orders of medication, sequencing of medications. But again, this is where monitoring would be so important to look at both symptom improvement as well as possible side effects.
So it's almost a trial by error type of...
Unfortunately, it's still at that point.
Does suicide run in families?
Yes. And part of... There's more genetic research that'll be coming through that sorts out the depression from suicidality proneness. In families, it's difficult to do those studies because you could argue there's some modeling, somebody being aware that another family member did this in some ways, lowering the threshold for this being a reasonable, quote, unquote, solution to a problem or a family legacy or whatever. But there have been studies of families where this, you know, looks pretty clear in terms of a pattern. We're trying to understand sort of the interaction between the environment and what you're kind of prone to genetically. It doesn't mean that you're destined to do that. It just means, like any other illness, if you know you have a likelihood of, you know, heart disease or something like that, you need to monitor yourself and be more careful. So in this case, you could be monitoring your mood better and not have this sort of predetermined outcome.
Is there a difference between clinical depression? What is the definition of a clinical depressed person?
You'll have these symptoms of hopelessness, some physical symptoms of sleep problems, sometimes appetite more or less, sometimes no desire to live, no hope for the future. There's a list that the NIMH webpage has that you can go through, and these symptoms typically have to be there for at least 2 weeks. So it's not just that you had a bad day, but it's something that's enduring for a while and it's becoming troublesome and it's probably affecting your daily functioning. So it's all a characterization of a pattern of behaviors. So that's why I think this is somewhat of a challenge to sort out where the medication's helping maybe some of those symptoms and not all of them, and where some of the symptoms might be related to the side effects. It's a very complicated picture.
But can depression be caused by an incident in a person's life, a death, a divorce, that type of thing?
Sure. There's probably 10% of people who experience a significant loss don't recover from that in a time that you would expect most people to get through this. And some people have talked about a depression with bereavement that sometimes gets treated and people feel better. Sometimes people don't treat it and it gets better on its own. And then there's this smaller group, this 10%, that might have a complicated bereavement where it's pretty clear that somebody's not coping well. There's some very severe symptoms around the depression or even unusual cognitions about did the person really die or not, or a very extreme longingness for the person that somebody just can't get past. I mean, everybody has these waves of grief, I think, but this is very debilitating. It's not a diagnostic category, but people in the grief field have talked about it. So that's one instance. There's also depression that might be related to PTSD. Depression often comes with other illnesses. Some people who are anxious or have obsessive compulsive disorder can have depression. So many times these same medications are used with people with other problems as well, which is also a challenge to sort out where the side effects are coming with these medications.
So whatever the reason for the depression, the medication is good. It's just you have to find that balance of how it's becoming going to be effective for the patient without harming the patient.
Finding the right medication, the right dose, and also understanding how far it can go with that. So we have some studies that show some psychotherapies working with medication can address a broader range of the depressive symptoms. And depending on when the depression came up, if it's trying to manage a physical illness that you're depressed about or stressful life events that are all accumulating, you could imagine that some type of psychotherapy might be very helpful in coping with that. Some people have talked about depression being sort of the depletion part of the stress, and can the medications kind of help your body jumpstart and get going, perhaps help you sleep better, because we know that's a huge risk factor for depression, just not sleeping well. So all of those are parts of the depression picture NIMH is trying to tackle in terms of getting people well faster and also understanding the different components of it to address.
We'll be talking about this for months, maybe years to come. These studies are going to go on for how long?
Some of these are looking at patterns of treatment in large healthcare systems. So one of them is looking at the VA system. Some are looking through Medicare, Medicaid data sets. Some are looking at new samples of some youth being treated by antidepressants so we can understand the pattern of where the side effects occur, for whom they occur, and try to get a better handle on that. And it's using more careful methods of side effect measurement.
We will definitely be doing a follow-up with you, Dr. Pearson, Dr. Jane Pearson, who once again is chair of the National Institutes of Mental Health Suicide Research Consortium. Thank you so much for joining us.
Sure, my pleasure.
Bill, back to you.
Thank you, Cherry. When we come back, Wally Akinzo tells us how a gene has been linked to tobacco addiction. That's next on NIH Research Radio. At the NIH, we know there's much to be learned from families, especially where one brother or sister has rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, scleroderma, or myositis, and the other does not. Now, does that sound like your family? Log on to clinicaltrials.gov or call 866-999-1116. If you're eligible, study-related tests are free. You'll be compensated for your time, and transportation may be reimbursed. The National Institutes of Health is a nonprofit government agency and part of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Why do some people get addicted to nicotine easier than others? The answer may be in the genes. Wally Akinzo has the report.
Results of a unique genetic study bring scientists one step closer to understanding why some casual smokers become addicted to nicotine. The study, funded by the National Institute on Drug Abuse, represents the most powerful and extensive evidence to date of genetic risk factors for tobacco addiction. According to Dr. Joni Rutter, NIDA's Associate Director for the Division of Basic Neurosciences and Behavioral Research.
This is a unique study that combined the strengths of two strategies to find genes for nicotine dependence, and it identified some new genes to spark new avenues of research, and it also identified different genetic variants from some of the old genes that addiction researchers are familiar with, and hopefully it will inspire a fresh look at how these genes are working in addiction. And I think this is really crucial work because further research on the genetics of nicotine addiction and the findings from this study will hopefully do three things. One, we think it'll help us understand the biology behind nicotine dependence and possibly addictions in general. The second thing is that it'll help identify other therapeutic targets for future medication development. Finally, it will help us to use these genetic variants to better understand how to prevent and treat nicotine addiction and possibly other addictive disorders.
To identify those genes that could potentially contribute to nicotine dependence, scientists combined a comprehensive genome-wide scan with the more traditional approach that focuses on a limited number of candidate genes using unrelated nicotine-dependent smokers as cases and unrelated non-dependent smokers as controls. Dr. Rutter said, a candidate gene has one or more variant forms which appear to be linked to a genetic disease.
Nicotine dependence is a really important public health problem. Each year, approximately 5 million deaths worldwide can be attributed to diseases caused by tobacco use. So efforts like this large-scale genetic study are really crucial for understanding what genetic factors increase a person's risk of transitioning from sort of casual use of the drug to continual use or addiction. And some people say, well, why don't you just quit? And for most people who are dependent, it isn't really that easy. We know that there are biological reasons that make it difficult to quit.
Tobacco use, primarily in the form of cigarette smoking, is a leading contributor to disability and death worldwide. Each year, approximately 440,000 Americans die of smoking-related illnesses. Dr. Rutter said, the hope is that continued identification of genes will not only help researchers predict who will become addicted, but will also help identify who will respond best to specific sensation therapies. This is Wally Akinzo at the National Institutes of Health, Bethesda, Maryland.
Results of a study supported by the National Institute on Drug Abuse suggest that young African-American adults, but not young white adults, are at risk for HIV and other sexually transmitted diseases, even when their relative level of risk behaviors is low. These findings imply that the marked racial disparities in the prevalence of these diseases are not exclusively affected by individual risk behaviors.
There's more than just risk behaviors involved, because for equal patterns of risk behavior, there's disparate likelihood of getting infected with an STD or HIV. The findings are not surprising. We kind of knew this. What is really new about this study is that it's one of the few that has actually tried to look at the pattern of risk behaviors and how much it contributes to the observed disparities that we've seen for years in this country across ethnic groups.
That was Dr. Jacques Normand, director of the AIDS Research Program at NIDA. He explained what needs to be determined in future research on this issue.
There's two fronts on that. One is to find out exactly what the underlying causal mechanisms are. What are the key factors that are facilitating the observed disparities that we're seeing? And two is what kind of prevention interventions would be more effective in trying to address those disparities that we're observing.
Dr. Normand said environmental, institutional, and contextual influences, such as differences in social and dating patterns, are among the many factors identified by researchers that may play a role in one's risk for HIV. The study authors recommend continuing a proactive strategy to reach all African-American young adults, including universal screening and expanding information, testing, and treatment services to non-traditional venues such as churches, beauty salons and barbershops, colleges, prisons, and jails. And with that, we come to the end of this episode of NIH Research Radio. Please join us on Friday, December 29th, when episode 22 of NIH Research Radio will be available for download. These stories are also available on the NIH Radio News Service website, www.nih.gov/news/radio. Our daily 60-second feature, NIH Health Matters, is heard on nearly 1,000 radio stations nationwide, as well as on XM Satellite Radio and on the Health Star Radio Network. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please feel free to contact me. If we use your comment, we'll send you something nice from the NIH gift shop. That email address, schmalfew@od.nih.gov. I'm your host, Bill Schmalfeld. NIH Research Radio is a presentation of the NIH Radio News Service, part of the News Media Branch, Office of Communications and Public Liaison, in the Office of the Director at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, an agency of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.